This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. COVID-19 infection rates continue to go up across the state due to the Delta variant and unvaccinated individuals. Is the data alarming, or is this just a temporary spike as we get settled back into hybrid lifestyles of online and in-person working and learning, with more of a focus on people trying to get back in person? With us now to tell us about the data, what the numbers mean, and where we seem to be headed is Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, you've been covering these COVID numbers very closely. What is the biggest takeaway right now?
Honestly, it's the rapid climb. We hit pandemic low hospitalizations in July, and now we're back to late January numbers. In June, we hit a pandemic low average of 242 cases per day. And in August, we've averaged 2,900 cases per day. Nearly 100,000 new confirmed cases in August, and we are still increasing. I think it's actually nearly 90,000 new confirmed cases in August. And because nearly half of all Hoosiers aren't vaccinated, pediatric hospitalizations are increasing significantly, while children are dealing also with not only COVID, but also RSV, which is a common respiratory infection, but can be deadly in younger children.
A lot going on. And these numbers, I mean, they sound pretty alarming to go from 242, you said, to 2,900. It just seems like in a matter of weeks. If you look over the last week or 2 weeks, is that what we're seeing, just a continued significant jump?
Yeah, it's to put it mildly, it's bad. Let's qualify it this way. So in all of July, we reported 142 deaths. In the 7 days from August 20th to August 26th, we've reported 141 deaths. What we enjoyed with this, you know, deaths slowing down to a trickle, hospitalization slowing down to a trickle, cases slowing down to a trickle, we are no longer at that point. And in fact, we are we're still climbing. There are some hopeful epidemiologists, predominantly of Twitter, who are hopeful that we are seeing that peak really soon. But a lot of healthcare professionals, state health officials are not convinced that our peak is fast approaching.
Well, on Friday, Dr. Chris Box held a press conference and had some strong words. Let's take a listen and then we'll discuss.
The next 2 to 4 weeks, or even maybe as long as 6 weeks, things are going to get worse. If Hoosiers do not start wearing masks to prevent transmission and more Hoosiers don't get vaccinated.
So it sounds like what you just mentioned, state health officials are not so optimistic about what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, when we see that increase of cases, it means that deaths and hospitalizations are, you know, several weeks behind. So the strain that we're seeing on our hospital systems are only going to get worse for the next several weeks, maybe even into October, maybe even into late October. And as far as deaths go, that increase we're going to see will also continue much later into the year. So it's, she's absolutely right. It's only going to get worse, even if we do see our cases start to take the nosedive that we anticipate with the Delta variant, like we saw in the UK, like we saw in India.
I wonder, you know, with the winter coming in and folks being indoors, if that's one of the reasons health officials are concerned, because, I mean, it seems like it's just only a matter of time before it spreads in indoor settings.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes, we are going to see some of that happening for sure. And health officials health professionals are absolutely confident of that as well. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, comparing August 2020 to August 2021. And that's a little bit of a false equivalency, because the way that our cases are going right now, we are in November of 2020, not in August. So whether or not, you know, being indoors extends this surge, or, you know, we continue to see those cases, you know, maintaining for a longer period of time than otherwise we would anticipate with the Delta variant, those are a lot of the unknowns that public health professionals and medical professionals are really concerned about.
We keep hearing how the virus spreads, particularly this Delta variant, just so quickly, especially in unvaccinated individuals. Was it premature? Are any health officials talking about sending kids back to school without mask mandates in place?
Yeah, so time has no meaning. I think this was a couple of weeks ago. A few doctors from Riley Hospital for Children's and Depressed Conference to talk about the significant increase in pediatric hospitalizations due to COVID-19. Around the same time period, I also talked to Indiana Twitter's favorite doctor, Gabriel Boslett, who's a pulmonary and critical care physician and professor at Indiana University School of Medicine. And all three really stressed the importance of masks in preventing pediatric hospitalizations. But to say that it was premature to send kids into schools without mask mandates might be a little bit too far. Boslett said he was very much in the camp of COVID-19 having less of an effect on kids, and the assumption that it was the risks were significantly lower, and so it wasn't as big of a deal as long as, you know, there were regular hand washing and other things like that. But the Delta variant is proving that thinking wrong, and that is playing out in pediatric hospital admissions due to COVID-19. In July, Indiana reported 66 pediatric COVID-19 hospital admissions. In August, that has jumped to 251. Which also makes it, just for August, doubled the number of pediatric hospitalizations from the previous 4 months. We're seeing schools starting to adapt and respond, and a lot of schools aren't responding nearly as quickly. But one thing that we are not seeing a whole lot of is mandates or a lot of strong guidance from the state.
If you have any questions or comments for the program, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're discussing COVID-19 infection rates across the state with digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, Lauren Chapman. Lauren, you mentioned that some schools aren't doing things quick enough. So I've also heard that they're not reporting their positive cases. Some schools aren't. Is there a reason for that? And are there any repercussions for not including that data?
Yeah. So last year, there was a bit of a, I don't want to say laissez-faire approach, but I'm going to say laissez-faire approach to demanding that schools report that data, that they report positive cases to the Indiana Department of Health and or the Indiana Department of Education. At the press conference on Friday that we heard the audio from Dr. Boxwith, she said that it's codified in state law to report cases in communal settings, which includes schools. And so right now, IDOH is trying to work with schools to educate them on those requirements and get everyone reporting. But right now, I don't think we're even at quite half of Indiana schools reporting. And even with that few schools reporting, Indiana broke an all-time pandemic record with more than 4,000 student cases reported in a single week last week. For context, that's not quite double our previous high from November of last year. So IDOH is trying to figure out how to get everyone on board, but they're certainly raising the flag to try and get schools to comply.
Are we seeing schools as the primary spreader this time around due to the fact that many young children aren't even eligible to get vaccinated?
I mean, with the rapid increase in cases, I don't think most epidemiologists would actually argue that, no. What we're seeing is community spread. A little less than half of all Hoosiers are unvaccinated, and that's not nearly enough to develop community protection against COVID-19. The vaccine hesitancy, which, to be clear, can run the gamut from systemic fears of healthcare providers, conspiracy theorists, or, you know, the very real socioeconomic barriers to getting the vaccine and having time to deal with any potential side effects. The vaccine hesitancy is still in younger Hoosiers, and the greatest increases that we're seeing in cases by age group in children are 10 to 14, an age group that is partially, you know, available to get vaccinated, but doesn't have the agency to make those medical decisions themselves.
You've spoken a lot with health officials, and I know you had a recent conversation with Dr. Peter Emby. I'm going to play a clip of his first, and then we'll talk a little bit more about that. Let's take a listen.
The fact of the matter is that those who are vaccinated still may be getting some of these infections, and maybe to a higher rate than was happening with the previous version of the virus, but they are very, very highly protected.
So, yeah, Dr. Emby is mentioning the vaccination and how, you know, even if you, I guess, get a breakthrough infection, you're still pretty much protected.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding for what breakthrough cases mean, at least is playing out in my Twitter mentions currently. And the fundamental misunderstanding is that the vaccine will prevent all cases. What we are currently experiencing in Indiana is community spread. I think that the CDC's map, I haven't checked it today, but I think every Indiana county is currently red. So with community spread, the vaccines aren't going to prevent all infections. Vaccines aren't effective 100% of the time, no matter what vaccine you get. But what they are doing very, very effectively is preventing severe illness and death. But it is also still true that as we see these increase in more cases, which we don't have a firm timeline, even when the state's dashboard updates once a week, we don't have like the timeline in order to compare an apples to apples, you know, number of cases to number of breakthrough cases reported in a single week. But more cases does lead to more hospitalizations and does lead to more deaths. Since Indiana fully vaccinated its first person on January 18th, 3,254 Hoosiers have died from COVID-19, and only 93 of them were fully vaccinated. But what's almost more important as a data point is that more than a quarter of those 93 breakthrough deaths have been reported in the month of August. And that's because we're seeing community spread. And it's, I mean, it really goes back to what Dr. Fox said during the press conference Friday, that getting more people vaccinated means we don't have to deal with surges like this again. And, you know, even 70% of eligible Hoosiers, you know, being fully vaccinated would make a huge impact on future variants and on future surges for Indiana.
Well, before we let you go, if you compare this time last year to what's happening now, is there anything worrisome in terms of numbers?
Yeah, I think it goes back to, you know, how long does this stretch out for, right? When you're talking about more people being indoors and more congregate settings, you know, during the winter, are we going to see more echoes of Delta, you know, well into November and December? Or are we, you know, once we get through the peak of this variant, are we truly out of the woods?
Well, thank you so much, Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Up next, abortion restrictions in Texas are grabbing headlines, but what about what's happening here in Indiana? A judge ruled last month that several state laws are unconstitutional. We'll discuss the details with our State House reporter. I'm Miriam Soh, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Last month, a federal judge ruled that several state laws restricting abortions are unconstitutional. The Attorney General's office is appealing. Judge Sarah Evans Barker of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana issued a permanent injunction barring state employees from enforcing or administering certain provisions. With us now to talk more about the case is Brandon Smith, State House reporter, Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Brandon.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the background on this case for those who haven't even been following it. Why was it taken to federal court?
Yeah, and you'd be forgiven for not following it. It's taken literal years to get to this point. And that's because the principal group behind it, this is a group called Whole Woman's Health. They are an abortion provider, not just here in Indiana, but across the country. They first took Indiana court several years ago because they were trying to open a clinic in South Bend, and Indiana was throwing up roadblocks left and right. And eventually they had to go to court to get the federal courts to tell Indiana to give them the license for the clinic. But that also expanded out then into a larger lawsuit that basically challenged just about every Indiana abortion regulation on the books. I mean, pretty much every single one. And this effort to get them struck down really goes back to a case involving Whole Woman's Health from, I want to say it was 2014 or 2015, out of Texas, which challenged a system of abortion regulations in that state. And what the Supreme Court at that time said was courts have to look at a sort of balancing test that, you know, the state has to provide evidence for why the abortion regulations are good, and those who are living under those restrictions can provide evidence for why they are unconstitutionally restricting people's access to abortion. And so looking at all that evidence, then you decide whether or not an abortion regulation is constitutional or not. It was a real landmark case in abortion jurisprudence. And based on that decision, Whole Woman's Health here, joined by other abortion providers in the state, abortion doctors and clinics, took Indiana's abortion system to court and said, okay, using that framework that was laid out in that earlier U.S. Supreme Court decision, we think all of these laws are unconstitutional, and here's all the reasons why. Now, again, they didn't win on all of those arguments, but they did get, at least at this initial level, several significant regulations struck down.
So with the judge's ruling, what does that mean can and can't happen now?
Yeah, I can tell you what the decision says is and is not constitutional. As to what it actually means for the state is a larger question that is kind of left hanging for the moment, and I'll explain that in a second. But let me get to the actual decision for a second. There are a few key things that it struck down. A big one is Indiana has, for several years, banned the use of telemedicine for abortion care. So that's seen obviously not in a surgical abortion because you can't do that via telemedicine, but the most commonly used abortion care is the abortion pill process or medication abortions. It's actually two pills, I should say. And Indiana, through telemedicine and its increasing use of telemedicine in a lot of other facets of healthcare, has been prescribing medication via telemedicine for years now. And the state has been encouraging that, particularly during the pandemic. We saw an even further expansion of telemedicine because it is safe and effective. And abortion providers argued, well, why is that not true for abortion care, which has fewer negative health consequences than a lot of the other things that we are allowed to prescribe via telemedicine in Indiana? Well, the federal court agreed. They struck down the ban on telemedicine for abortion care because, as Judge Barker said in her ruling, the state offered little to no justification for the law. Some of the other things that the lawsuit eliminated in terms of Indiana law was an in-person examination requirement. So it said that people had to be, before their abortion, had to be examined by the physician in person before they could have the procedure. Well, Judge Barker wrote that that requirement does not offer any benefits that are necessary to ensure the safe provision of medication abortion services. Similarly, the law said only physicians could write the prescriptions for those medication abortions, which Barker wrote the state offered at best a weak justification for that because it doesn't really match up with what the medical community says is and is not safe. So those are some of the really big things that the lawsuit struck down. There's also provisions in state law that determine what kind of abortions can be provided at certain facilities. For instance, one regulation limits second trimester abortions to hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. But there are no surgical centers in Indiana that perform those abortions, and only four hospitals that do so, all in the Indianapolis areas. And on top of that, those hospitals will only perform the procedures when the health of the patient is in question. So essentially what the judge wrote is that it's basically almost impossible for women in Indiana to get second trimester abortion care because they can't access it. And so she struck down that requirement. Again, pointing to the fact that the state's arguments for why these laws should remain in place don't really hold up to scrutiny. Now, there are things that did survive the judge's ruling. For instance, one included a requirement that only doctors can perform surgical abortions. Now, the abortion providers had argued that advanced practice nurses could have training and could do those things. But Judge Barker wrote that those procedures are more complex and that they benefit from physicians who have higher skill sets than physician assistants or those nurse practitioners that I mentioned. Additionally, the judge found that an Indiana law that requires an ultrasound before an abortion is constitutional. And then there were some others that were upheld. A law requiring doctors who provide abortions to have admitting privileges at a local hospital, or at least an agreement with a physician who does. A statute requiring Hoosiers under the age of 18 to get parental consent for abortion, and a few others. Now, you asked, what will this actually mean for Indiana going forward, at least in the short term? Whether or not this ruling ultimately remains in place is very much up in the air, in part because you referenced that Texas case that the U.S. Supreme Court just acted on overnight, as well as some other cases at the U.S. Supreme Court, the federal appeals process and all of that. I personally am, I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on TV, and I'm personally a little skeptical that the judge's ruling will ultimately survive the appeals process, because I think the U.S. Supreme Court is going to largely gut legalized abortion in this country.
If you have any questions or comments for our program, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, about some of the recent rulings with regards to abortion here in Indiana. You know, Brandon, I'm curious to know how the Attorney General's appeal affects all of this. And is it common for politicians to get this involved in topics? I mean, I guess it is in most instances, but it just seemed surprising to me that the Attorney General like jumped on this right away.
I'm not surprised at all. So for two reasons. One, it is the role of the Attorney General in the state of Indiana to appeal decisions like this. This was a lawsuit challenging Indiana state law. The Attorney General's office was defending Indiana in court, as it does in any case. An appeal in this case, however the judge was going to rule, if she had said every Indiana abortion law is okay, if she had said none of them are okay, or this mix, this case was always going to get appealed. It's that sort of decision. I'm not surprised at all that the Attorney General's office jumped on it right away, A, because it's their role, but B, because this particular Attorney General is extremely conservative. He considers himself an ardent anti-abortion advocate. And so he was always going to challenge any ruling that tried to restrict what Indiana was trying to do in terms of anti-abortion laws. So no, this was in line both with his statutory obligations as Attorney General and also his personal political beliefs.
Is Indiana the only state with these types of laws with regards to abortion? I know the stuff that's happening in Texas right now is sounds a little bit harsher than what we have in Indiana. But what is, I guess, Indiana's outlook overall compared to other parts of the state, in the country, I should say?
Yeah, Indiana's right in line with a lot of other parts of the country. There is very little on the books and in terms of Indiana abortion regulations that aren't on the books in other parts of this country, which was partly why that this lawsuit at least had some chance of being at least partially successful, which it has been so far, which is that, you know, if you read the decision, there are precedents in other states that show that some of these laws just simply are not constitutional depending on the impact they have on people's access to abortion. That's the trick, as I explained earlier, where this case sort of came from, is you have to look at the facts of the individual state. So for instance, sometimes with new laws, you can't really you won't see them struck down right away. That's the case here. There were a couple of these laws that the judge ruled unconstitutional that had previously been held as constitutional, but that's because when they were first challenged, well, we didn't know what the impact will be. We now know what the impact is. There's lots of data and evidence to show that it is they create significant obstacles to people's access to abortion in this state. And so that's why you saw the judge strike down several of these things. Again, though, Indiana is not out on the forefront of abortion legislation. It never really has been. There are bills offered each year that would go a lot further than other states, but those rarely, if ever, get even a hearing, let alone a vote in either chamber. So, no, Indiana is right in line with most states that significantly limit abortion.
Does this issue seem like something that will continue to flip-flop based on which political party holds the majority?
Yes. You have Democrats in this state who abortion regulations weren't only created under Republicans in Indiana. And you still have Democrats in the state house right now who vote for anti-abortion laws because they are more conservative. They represent more conservative districts or are personally more conservative. Not many anymore because of the way that the partisanship in the state house has really been pushed to the edges in a lot of ways. But yeah, to a certain extent, if Democrats were to take control of the Indiana House and the Indiana Senate anytime soon, which seems extremely unlikely, things would flip a little bit. But really, it's more dependent now on what happens at the U.S. Supreme Court and at the federal level.
With what's going on in Texas right now, how is that going to have an impact on Indiana?
Yeah, it will less so on the Texas law and more on a Mississippi law that's going to be heard at the Supreme Court next month. And we will probably get a ruling on, I would suspect, next May or June, because that's normally the timeline for the Supreme Court. That Mississippi law bans abortions at 15 weeks, which would be the earliest time you could ban abortion if it is upheld in the country. Right now, Indiana is like many other states, about the earliest at 20 weeks, which is what the Supreme Court has historically said is okay. If the U.S. Supreme Court upholds the Mississippi law or goes even further and largely guts legalized abortion from its precedents in Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that could have an even bigger impact on the sorts of laws that Indiana passes, but also whether or not this ruling from the federal judge over Indiana's laws survives. So I think, for instance, it's getting appealed, as you said, by the attorney general. My suspicion is that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals might wait to rule on the case until the Supreme Court acts on the Mississippi law or potentially the Texas law in another form or fashion, but most likely the Mississippi law first, and then use that ruling, if it is more definitive, to look at this ruling from the Indiana judge under a slightly different lens.
So what do you think would be next now? Pending this appeal, you think they'll just wait for whatever the Supreme Court decides for this Mississippi case?
Yeah, I think in terms of the universe of abortion regulation, not just in Indiana, not just in the federal courts, but across the country, I think everybody on both sides, quite frankly, is to a certain extent holding their breath and waiting to see what the U.S. Supreme Court does in this Mississippi case. We'll see. Like I said, my personal, and this is, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just somebody who reads and watches and has been doing this for a decade. My personal opinion is it looks an awful lot like this, like the U.S. Supreme Court is about to gut abortion rights in this country. And when I say that, it would be left up to individual states to decide how far to restrict abortion rights. And Indiana, if it is given that opportunity, will seek to all but ban abortion entirely.
Well, it sounds almost similar as I try to move on to another topic real quick before we wrap up, to how states are dealing with COVID and how it's up to each state to decide what to do. So speaking of COVID cases in the state and the rise in cases, as we were talking about earlier this afternoon, the battle of masking and not masking continues to come up. Where does the state stand right now on this issue?
It's entirely up to local elected officials. The governor has washed his hands entirely of making any sort of decision on mask mandates. And that's not just in the community or statewide. He's also decided that that's how he's going to approach a statewide mask mandate in schools. Now, that mask mandate in schools existed up until June, I believe, of this year. After June, the state said, well, local school officials can decide what they want to do on masks in their buildings. And the governor is sticking to that, despite the alarming rise in cases statewide, despite the alarming rise of cases among young people, the alarming rise of hospitalizations in young people. The governor has said, not my job anymore. Local officials said they want to decide, so I'm just going to wash my hands of it.
Has there been anything like this in the history of the state where it's been up to local officials to make decisions on something so significant?
Indiana likes to think of itself as a state that values local authority, that they believe the government closest to the people is the best. But that comes with a big old asterisk because depending on who's in power, they like to make decisions at a statewide level all the time. They have stopped local units of government from enacting any gun restrictions. They've stopped local units of government from banning plastic bags, as Bloomington tried to do several years ago. So when they've decided that at the state level they want to set a policy, they do that. And when they've decided that they think it will be politically convenient for them to have local officials set policy at the local level, that's what they decide.
When it comes to these school boards having to make these decisions, we heard earlier from Farah Yousry on some reports about just these tensions between parents and school board members. Do you think there will be a time when the state sees stuff kind of getting out of control and says, okay, wait, we're going to actually take a decision and everybody has to follow it?
I don't anymore, no. The governor has made it pretty clear that he is just unwilling to speak on this issue any further at a state level. He's decided that it's up to local officials, and I really don't see anything changing his mind.
All right. Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, Brandon Smith, State House reporter, Indiana Public Broadcasting. Always a pleasure to have you on. Just ahead, what happens to refugees fleeing their countries, and where do they get help if they find themselves here in Indiana? We'll get an update from an organization that works with refugees here in the state. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. By now, you may have seen the harrowing images of people trying to flee Afghanistan as the Taliban took over the country. Many refugees may end up in unfamiliar places, probably needing to learn the language and the culture and restart their lives. It's a difficult process to leave everything you know behind. And when it comes to our state, what are we doing to help those in need? With us now to talk more about this is Cole Varga, Executive Director of Exodus Refugee Immigration. Welcome to the program, Cole.
Hi, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
In a world of uncertainty, how does that affect refugees?
Well, there's no shortage of uncertainty right now, and in particular with the many Afghans that are coming who had to flee very abruptly. I think the trauma and the shock of both their country falling apart and the loss of their homeland, the loss of family and friends that they're leaving behind. It's a very abrupt and traumatic experience going on right now.
And what's being done right now in Indiana that you're aware of when it comes to the Afghan refugees in particular?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So first of all, resettlement has been happening here in Indiana for decades and indeed across the whole of the United States. So on a normal basis, monthly, weekly, even, we are welcoming refugees from all over the world already to cities in Indiana, Indianapolis, where we're focused, Fort Wayne, and occasionally some other smaller cities. But in terms of this effort, this is something new and different on a level that we haven't seen in my career or perhaps in a generation with this Afghan evacuation. So the main thing right now is ramping up efforts at Camp Atterbury, which is a temporary situation, which I've heard will house up to 5,000 Afghan evacuees at any given moment while they're finishing up the processing of their visas, their last checking the last boxes of medical checks, getting the vaccination that'll be offered to them, getting COVID tests, applying for work authorization cards. So they're sort of the last final processing things that in a normal time would happen overseas, for example, in a refugee camp or at a U.S. embassy. But because of the urgency, all of that is being flown over here and done stateside at now Camp Atterbury as of today, I believe, as well as 8 or 9 other bases and forts across the U.S.
And so Indiana has a primary role with resettling or bringing in refugees here. Is it just one particular part of the state, or are you seeing this spreading across the state to different towns and cities?
Yeah, so with our typical resettlement role, it's primarily focused around the Marion County and a little bit into the Donut Counties, and then the Fort Wayne area, and once in a while in South Bend. That may change in the future as resettlement is poised to increase under the Biden administration. For reference, the president of the United States actually gets to set the refugee target, the refugee ceiling for admissions each year. And we'll be moving to a much larger target here in fiscal year 2022 under Biden, which will be raising it by 110,000 over the past number set by President Trump. So quite an increase. So we might see more cities involved. But over the past several years, Indianapolis and Fort Wayne being the primary sites and the primary groups coming to those cities being Burmese in Indianapolis and Burmese in Fort Wayne as well, two of the larger groups in those cities.
Well, when it comes to Indiana, is our state prepared to handle an influx of refugees?
Definitely. You know, we've been doing this at Exodus Refugee for 40 years, and between our efforts, the efforts of our friends at the local Catholic Charities Office that do this good work as well, as well as the Catholic Charities Office in Fort Wayne, there's tons of volunteers, tons of good people in the community that help us out, whether it's churches or businesses who hire refugees or the school systems that serve refugee kids so well. Our good friends in Perry Township being some of the prime examples of that. So yes, we can, and we have been welcoming refugees. In terms of what this will look like over the next couple of months, I'm not quite sure of the numbers, but it won't be an inundating, overwhelming number of people. The people coming to Atterbury will not be staying at Atterbury and will not be remaining in Indianapolis. They'll be resettled across the U.S. So they might end up in cities like Sacramento, or they might go to Lexington, or they might go to Columbus, Ohio. It's really going to depend on a couple of factors, the first of which being if they know someone in the U.S. already who can serve as sort of an anchor and friend to them. So if someone has an uncle in Louisville, they're probably going to Louisville to resettle and get services there.
I mean, that's really tough, just the whole having to flee your country and then in the middle of a pandemic. And then once you get here, then you have to be moved around to different places. Is there anything that is out there to help refugees to navigate that process so they don't feel so alone?
Well, that's sort of where our office comes in. I think right now this processing that's happening at the base is probably very new and jarring for many people. But the reality is they got out and they are safe, and that was the most important thing to accomplish in this mission. So I believe these families, these refugees and evacuees will be in these camps and bases on the U.S. for probably a couple of weeks while they finish all this processing. But that's when they will get turned over and allocated to offices like Exodus and 200 other offices like us across the U.S. And this is really our wheelhouse of helping walk them through life in a new city, in their new hometown, if you will. So we'll be there at the airport when they get off the plane, or perhaps if any do resettle from Atterbury, they might be on the bus and we'll be there to pick them up. We'll take them to an apartment that we'll have set up and furnished for them through donated items. We'll help enroll their kids in school. We'll get the adults in E&L and English classes that we offer over Zoom right now during the pandemic. We'll help them find their first jobs in the U.S. through all of our employment partners. We have free mental health services we offer through our agency. So really wraparound case management and supportive services through the resettlement network that are already in existence and are trying to ramp up as quickly as possible to be ready for any and all Afghans that are allocated to us.
I mean, it sounds like you have a great process in place for all aspects of the journey. With the amount of Afghan refugees expected to come to Camp Atterbury, has that had an impact on your organization, or have you not felt it yet? I mean, just getting ready and being prepared for a large group of people.
Yeah. So, again, the Atterbury folks, most of them will probably not be staying in Indiana. In fact, probably almost all of them will be resettled to states across the U.S. But some may resettle through us. They may come from Fort Lee, Virginia, or they may come down from Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, or some of these other places. But once they do come, and however many that is, we'll for sure be ready to receive them. And we've been talking a little bit with partners who are running the Atterbury efforts down there, our friends at the Red Cross, who are doing a great job getting set up there, along with some other NGOs and government partners. So mostly we're not involved in that aspect, but just kind of lending a hand and talking about what's going to happen after they leave after Atterbury, whether it's in Indianapolis or other cities. So preparing for spreading the knowledge of resettlement to whomever needs to learn about this process.
Well, when we talk about refugees as a whole, not just the folks coming in from Afghanistan, but from other countries around the world, what would you say are the main reasons that folks end up refugees for our listeners to understand, aside from, you know, war, persecution? Are there any other reasons?
Yeah, so right now there's about 26 million refugees in the world. And if we included other displaced individuals, that number, I think it approaches about 82 million, according to the United Nations. So this is, you know, about 1% of the global population. That's a huge amount of people that are not living in their homes right now because of security threats, because of persecution for based on religion, based on political opinion, based on gender even, or, you know, affiliation in a particular group. So members of the LGBTQ community, for example. So myriad reasons one could be a refugee. And frankly, it can happen to anyone and anywhere, as we've seen. We've had refugees resettle through Exodus over the past 40 years from 50 different countries, with more recently people coming from Burma here in Indianapolis. There's about 23,000 Burmese refugees in Indianapolis now. Refugees from the Democratic Republic of the Congo who have fled decades of violence in the eastern part of the Congo, neighboring Rwanda. Refugees from Eritrea, which is sort of a military state in the northeast of Africa. Refugees from China, even. Refugees from Sudan, from many countries across the globe. And it's persecution based on those items I outlined. People fleeing genocide, such as the Rohingya in Burma. Any number of human rights atrocities. But the good thing about all of this, at least for a certain swath of that group, is that the U.S. does have a resettlement program. And in fact, it's one of the best things we do as a country is welcome refugees in their time of need to resettle here and become Americans.
Are you hopeful that most of the refugees that come here are able to find work and shelter? Because I've heard stories before where, you know, maybe it's really, really tough and they end up feeling a culture shock and they want to go back.
The culture shock is real, of course, and coupled with, you know, sometimes perhaps the guilt or the shock of the loss of family and friends that have been left behind. Because, you know, if there's 26 million refugees in the world, only a very, very small fraction of those folks are getting invited on an annual basis to resettle in the United States. So we do what we can to help address that. We have cultural orientation classes. I mentioned mental health services already. And once you have an established larger group, such as the Burmese, community really comes into play. So the Chin community of Indianapolis, for example, several churches and businesses have sprung up that have really made the Indianapolis Burmese community a very vibrant and supportive community for newly incoming refugees.
Well, what can listeners do who are tuning in and want to know how they can take part in helping out refugees in the area?
Yeah, I'd say there's a couple of ways. So first of all, preparing for the unknown amount of Afghans, refugees that we'll be assisting in the next couple of weeks. In addition to the refugees we're helping through our normal pipeline of arrivals from everywhere from Syria to Burma to Congo, we are always accepting household donations. So on our website, exodusrefugee.org, there's a couple different options, whether that be picking items out of our Amazon wish list, donating a couch or a dinner table. All of these things help offset some upfront costs for new families as they start their new lives, and helps push whatever money they do have, which is not much at all, allow it to go a lot further as they acclimate and as they seek their first jobs to become self-sufficient. So household donations, in-kind items like that, but also, of course, cash donations are always accepted on our website as well, so we can be as flexible as possible in meeting whatever needs do come at us from the refugees we're serving. We also take volunteers. We have a few opportunities listed on our website, from teaching English to mentoring a family to helping be the first friend to a young refugee here as they make their way through public high school, after coming out of a refugee camp for many years. So we've had hundreds of volunteer applications in the past couple of weeks and are just so encouraged by the community support for this work. I'll also shout out our friends at the Red Cross, who are doing a lot of good work to prepare for refugees down at Camp Atterbury. They are also taking cash donations to respond to this urgent need and this Hoosier response to the refugee effort.
I know earlier we touched upon the fact that there are more refugees coming in now than perhaps in the previous administration. Are you seeing that change? Are you noticing a big difference the previous administration to now?
Yeah, it's an interesting moment right now. This year was actually on track and still may be, in fact, to be the lowest refugee arrival year in history. We were on track for maybe not even getting to 10,000 refugees arriving this year for a couple reasons, mostly based on Trump era policies that really restricted the refugee flows and some of it having to do with COVID protocols, of course. But, switching our sites from several low arrival years under the Trump administration and trying to prepare for a rejuvenation of the program under Biden's 125,000 refugee number. And in the midst of that, having 100,000 Afghan refugees show up on military transports creates for a very interesting time. But when we get into this work to help people, and that's the moment we're in. So we're going to do everything we can to step up and meet the moment.
Well, we have about a minute left. Are there any policies that need to change federally or locally?
Yeah, there's one in particular that we're keeping our eye on, and that has to do with Afghans specifically. So the Afghans entering right now are coming in three different types of buckets. So there's the SIVs, the special immigrant visa holders that we've read so much about. These are the interpreters and allies of U.S. military forces that worked alongside the U.S. for a year or two, and because of that are granted the special status. Those individuals will be fine. They're going to get their green card after processing, and they'll be taken care of by the resettlement network. The second bucket are P2 refugees, or priority 2 refugees. So these would be somewhat similar, but they're working not with the military per se, but with NGOs or media outlets from the West. And because of that, may face security risks from or reprisals from groups in Afghanistan. The third group is one of concern in terms of policy, and that's Afghans who are given humanitarian parole, which you'll forgive the term, but that's the status officially. It's a humanitarian entrant into the U.S., and because they're not coming as a under refugee status, they won't have the same access to public benefits such as Medicaid, such as food stamps in those early months that are so critical to adjust. So we hope the administration and our delegation here in Indiana, Senators Young and Braun and Carson, will help advocate for status for these entrants.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Cole Varga, Executive Director of Exodus Refugee Immigration. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.